Welcome. This is the UX Design Cast podcast series, and my name is Carl Vredenberg. This is episode number 10, and we have with us today Kevin Bury, who's principal designer, user interface designer at LinkedIn. Welcome, Kevin.
Thanks, Carl. It's a pleasure to be here.
That's great. I thought it was interesting that we linked up again after many years. We linked in through LinkedIn and now have reconnected ourselves. And that's actually led to this podcast interview. So that in itself is kind of interesting. So I'd love to know more about your role at LinkedIn, a little bit more about LinkedIn in case people don't know what LinkedIn is. That'd be a great way to start, I think.
Sure. I'm a principal user interface designer at LinkedIn. I'm part of a user experience and design team that includes designers and researchers. And LinkedIn, for people who don't know, is a social networking site that's targeted at professionals. So to contrast it to a MySpace or a Facebook that have a younger audience or a college audience, LinkedIn is very much targeted at the professional or pre-professional audience. So people put, instead of photos of their dogs up there, they put basically information about their professional life and their education and their jobs and what they've worked on. And it's a way for people to connect and network. So people use it for a variety of purposes. They use it to connect with people they've worked with in the past. And of course, all those people are potential people to work with again in the future, and all kinds of business relationships. So, the obvious ones are, looking for a job or trying to fill a position if you're a hiring manager, but then also people who are networking to form business partnerships, people looking for customers, people looking for business opportunities, do research on LinkedIn, and they build their network. And of course, you have your network of first-degree connections, and then those people are all connected to other people and so forth and so on. We also recently launched a number of new features around company groups. So one of the networks that you'll have if you work for a company is other folks who work in that company. And we have a variety of features there to help you leverage other folks within your company to start discussions, to reference news articles and stuff and share them with other people. And it's really a business tool. It's the purpose of it is that people are engaged in business and people who want to form new business relationships.
In fact, I've used some of those new features, and I use LinkedIn a lot, so I'm quite familiar myself with it and certainly endorse its use. It seems to me I've been on it for a fair while, and it seems to me like it's been around longer than the MySpaces and the Facebooks and all of that, but yet it seems to be changing rather dramatically over the last little while. And I actually recall reading some stats about year-to-year growth or month-to-month growth, and that Facebook seems to be stagnating somewhat. The latest statistics showed that LinkedIn is just absolutely going crazy in terms of increases in numbers of people that are actually signing up. So it seems like it's been around for a while, but now it's really kind of really rolling, and you've already described a little bit of maybe part of the reason for that, but I wonder if you could just tell us a little bit more about what kinds of transitions, LinkedIn is going through, and is it the case that there's a real burgeoning of increases in a number of users as we go over the last few months?
Yes, our month-to-month and year-to-year growth is very high. We add, I think, in excess of 1.2 million new users a month, and we're currently somewhere in the ballpark of 23 million. Users. So it's growing quite rapidly. And as you mentioned, on a percentage basis, it's growing faster than many of the other social networking sites. In absolute number, we're not as large as some of the others, but our growth is certainly very, very strong.
And it sounds like, Kevin, what you were describing as well, that there are probably some features that are in some of these other systems that would be useful in a more business-oriented connection site like LinkedIn. And it sounds like you're looking at some of those capabilities and building those into LinkedIn as well, and quite profitably, it sounds like. Wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about your role, what kinds of work you're doing there, also what kinds of, you know, interesting new things might be around the corner, what kinds of things are being considered, that kind of thing.
Well, I've been at LinkedIn for 2 months, so I'm relatively new, and I joined a team there. And so the interesting thing is none of the things that I've worked on have shipped yet. So although there's a number of exciting new features that have come out recently, they're all due to the very hard work of others. Mm-hmm. But the way I kind of look at it is I use the other social networking sites as well, and find them very useful for things such as fun things, basically. Mm-hmm. Sharing family photos, things like that. I'm speaking again as somebody who's fairly recently joined LinkedIn, but I've been a LinkedIn user for many years. I've always used LinkedIn for my professional face to the world, and really my business associations.
Mm-hmm. Now I wonder what kinds of differences there are. What kinds of things would be appropriate to do on a more business site? What things are really things that you'd never consider from the other kind of social networking sites in further developing what is obviously a very, very successful infrastructure and system called LinkedIn? And I realize you're relatively new, there, but maybe your own sort of thoughts on the ways in which you use, as a user, LinkedIn versus some of these other sites as well. What kinds of things would be a focus of direct use in a business kind of environment that may be, entirely different in a more social, playful and personal kind of system like Facebook or MySpace?
Sure. Well, I can give you my own example. This year I'm doing a job search. Mm-hmm. And basically doing the research for my job search using LinkedIn, keeping track of where people I've worked with in the past, where they are now, contacting them, getting leads and getting ideas about what some of the emerging technologies are and where some of what people perceive to be the growth areas. Obviously social networking was a big one. There's a ton of sites right now that are jumping on the social networking bandwagon, and of course it's really difficult to now, because it's kind of it's the classic kind of first mover phenomena, where the sites that got there early and established a set of users are the ones that have kind of been successful. And I use an example of that, YouTube. There are I heard a number recently, there are at least 1,000 sites out there that are for video and posting videos, most of which have a tiny fraction of users. YouTube obviously was one of the first players there, one of the most successful players. And so when people think of video, they don't think of those smaller players. They think of the leader in it, which is them. And I think that for social networking, we're still seeing how it's going to play out. My personal opinion is I think there's going to be a few different kind of sets of major players. Obviously, the professional is going to be one of those. I think the more fun side is going to be another one. There might be, two or three other segments that fall out of the mix. We just don't know yet. But I think clearly, business networking and those business associations is going to be huge.
Sounds exciting. That sounds like you're right in the middle of one of those major players as well in terms of what you're doing user interface wise at LinkedIn. Now, before LinkedIn, and I talked about that you've been at LinkedIn for a couple of months, but before that, most recently, you were at Yahoo, another very interesting and exciting place in many ways, but also very importantly for user interface design. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about your role there and what types of work you did there.
Sure. I was at Yahoo for 4 years, and I did several different things there. I was initially hired on as a lead user interface designer, and then I became a director of user interface design for the Hot Jobs property. Hot Jobs is what they call a property within Yahoo. It's owned by Yahoo, and led the team that did the design for that that set of products. And it is a set of products, both the job seeker product and the recruiter product, and a few others. And then from my last couple of years at Yahoo, I was director of user experience and design for what they call Yahoo Front Doors, which is the front door entry products to Yahoo. And those are yahoo.com, the Yahoo front page, My Yahoo, which is the personalized portal page, and then a couple of new products. One is one that's gotten a lot of press is Yahoo Buzz, mm-hmm. which is a what we call the vote to promote site, basically where people submit news articles and they get buzzed up, and the ones that get buzzed very highly get featured on the Yahoo homepage. And then one last product that's in beta called Yahoo Glue, which is currently in beta in India, and it's basically a faceted search product that allows people to do a search on a topic, and then instead of just seeing a boring set of search results, they actually get a composed page that has modules on it that, you know, maybe show pictures, maybe show maps, maybe show a variety of other things. So fascinating work, and very interesting, and really enjoyed my time there. For a variety of reasons, it was time for me to leave Yahoo, and so I'm very happy with the move I made, but, you know, I still have very warm feelings towards Yahoo and really admire the folks there, and had a great time while I was there.
There's also some really nice work that you did there. The beauty of this kind of thing is that you also can see the results of all that, and we'll also put the links to the things that we're talking about here in the show note, which are always available after these sessions. But you've been a user interface designer for many, many years now, and
many years.
And have a lot of experience. And I want to tap into a bit of that experience in a bit too, from the point of view of advice. But before we get to the my questions regarding any advice you might have, I wanted to just get from you what you're most proud of. What kinds of design work can you point to that you look at and say, ah, you know, boy, am I really glad that I did that work? And while it might have changed one or two things, I think it's really nice work.
I've been very fortunate in my career to be able to do a number of different things, both consumer software and enterprise software, and they're both interesting in their own ways. I think at the current point in my career, not to say that this won't change again, I'm very much enjoying kind of well, LinkedIn's kind of a mix. It definitely has a consumer face, but it also has kind of an enterprise side to it. I contrast that to, you know, my time at Aribo, where I was a lead designer on an enterprise sourcing product, which, if you don't know what enterprise sourcing is, don't worry about it. It's very specialized, and it was extremely complex, and it was interesting in its own way, but you know, it of course didn't have the reach that some of the other products I've worked on have. Obviously, the stuff at Yahoo had an enormous reach. You know, millions and millions of visitors, hundreds of millions of visitors, you know, a month seeing and using the stuff that my team worked on. LinkedIn, not as many, but still a vast number of people. My time at the Clara subsidiary of Apple was very enjoyable because I was lead designer on one of the versions of ClarisWorks, ClarisWorks 5.0, which became AppleWorks, which, you know, again, was hugely popular and very big in education, which was very rewarding. And also, I was lead designer on one of the early web authoring tools, Claris Homepage, which unfortunately got discontinued when Apple reabsorbed Claris, but that was also very exciting because it was kind of the early days of the web. And it really was one of the first WYSIWYG web authoring tools, and it was all very much a new territory and a new frontier. So that was very, very exciting.
That's quite a history, and it's actually interesting to, you know, a number of people that listen to this are, you know, people that are still considering what kinds of discipline they want to go into, or they know that it's this discipline or this set of disciplines that they'd like to go into, but they may not have chosen whether they want to go more of an academic route or whether they want to go for a more commercial sort of route. I think that you've exemplified the applying your trade in a very public environment, and one of the benefits that many people talk about with regard to doing design work in that kind of context is you get to see the result of the work that you and your teams do, because millions and millions of people actually see it and consume it and use it at any one time, and you also probably get feedback, praise, as well as probably some negative press occasionally, because you're touching that many people. But I wanted to ask you a little bit too about those were some of the real positives and instances where you're really proud of work that was done. And you know that our discipline, I think, has gone through some level of changes over the years, but there are still always, during any one phase, particular challenges that our discipline faces, whether it's technology, whether it's culture, whether it's the discipline's own capabilities itself. I wonder if you could let us know your thoughts on what you consider to be today's sort of biggest challenges facing user experience design types of disciplines.
Well, one thing that's become obvious to me is company cultures are radically different. And what is kind of expected and what is valued in one company can be very different than what is expected and valued in a different company. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I look for when you know, looking at a place to work, and one thing I certainly advise other people to do, is to really, you know, really get to know, you know, what the culture is, and whether, you know, their set of skills are a good fit. It's no fun work, you know. I hate to say it, but some companies will hire designers without really understanding what designers bring to the table, and they'll almost feel like they have to have designers, of course, right? But they don't really have an understanding, and there's no kind of, you know, within the executive ranks, really a knowledge of what designers do and what their value is. And so it's, you see designers that, and it's particularly for people in smaller companies that, you know, maybe they're the only designer there, and so they don't have another team, and they may be, you know, part of engineering, or they may be part of some other organization, which is, you know, not by itself necessarily bad, but they can be kind of pigeonholed into doing something that, you know, maybe is not necessarily what they, you know, where they could really bring the most value. And of course, the most value, in my opinion, is user-centered design. It's not just the implementation, although obviously that's very important. But it's you know, stepping back, it's understanding who the target audience is, understanding the use cases and the flows, and basically doing the analysis of what the possibilities are, you know, basic, you know, analysis of, you know, what of those requirements, how do the requirements distill down into the objects and actions that the user will be interacting with, you know, what are the basic flows around there, what are the alternatives, you know, doing some high level flows and use cases, and then beginning to move that forward. It's always a risk of, you know, jumping too quickly into, okay, we've got this new feature we want to do, and let's just bolt it on to the system. And that, of course, can be, you know, very problematic, and it's why there's so much bad software out there. It's because, you know, it's people are basically just bolting it on. One thing that's happened in the past few years that's been a big help to that is, frankly, Apple. And Apple has shown very clearly that good design sells. And so there's been kind of an increased awareness within the executive ranks, particularly here in Silicon Valley, that, you know, okay, this isn't just something that, you know, I'll use the phrase lipstick on a pig. It really is much more fundamental than that. And it's not about making the UI pretty. It's about thinking through what the user experience should be, and really taking that and transforming it into something that can be marketed and sold very successfully.
interesting that you bring up Apple, because I think what's interesting there as well is, as you say, it's really pulling together all the disciplines. I mentioned earlier, you know, the disciplines of user experience and design. It's not like there's only a single discipline. There are a variety of different components to this, and obviously it's direct partnership with, you know, the technology enablement and the building of this stuff as well. And Johnny Ives at Apple talks about that quite eloquently, the whole notion of having to bring it all together. What is your own sense and the kinds of culture that you've seen, maybe from other companies as well, on a sense of the relative contribution of the various disciplines? Because it strikes me that there's a lot of focus on the visual design elements of this stuff, the interaction design pieces of this, the technology enablement of it, and I think a lot of people don't realize that at Apple all those things come together so well that it makes it look really easy. But these are all individual contributions that need to be made. But what is your own experience with and your own sort of insights into the right way to bridge all of those disciplines and really leverage each of them to create that total user experience?
Well, I think you're exactly right when you say that when you have good design, everyone recognizes it as good design, and they kind of say, of course that's what you'd do. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's easy to look at the iPhone, and for instance, and it's, you know, there are things I don't like about it, but by and large, it's incredibly intuitive. And it really is, you know, especially if you compare it to some of the other offerings that are out there. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine came over last night because he was having difficulty connecting. I won't mention the device, but a different device to his wireless. And I was just horrified. It's the first time I had picked up the device of this type. It just how, you know, I'm a technologist, and I do this sort of thing every day. I couldn't figure it out. It was just horrid. So the challenge, of course, is, you know, we recognize it when we see it, and then how do we get there? And I think, in my mind, it's really, you know, starting with the basics, understanding, you know, number one, who the user is, and who you're trying to sell to, and who you're trying to get to be the users of your product, and there may be multiple segments, and then really doing the analysis up front about, you know, what are the most efficient mechanisms we can provide in the user interface to let them do their task without getting in their way. And then once you have that, then you know, applying and the visual language to it and putting that on. But it's very much an evolutionary process. Mm-hmm. And as you know, and I'm sure most of the listeners know, there's many, many ways to solve a design problem, and they all have trade-offs. And one of the things that designers do is to get those trade-offs in front of the team early and say, look, we could do alternative one, we could do alternative two, alternative three. They each have pluses and minuses. Get those in front. I always try to do like one pagers for each of those in some kind of flow or networked type flow diagram. But try to get at least the high level alternatives in front of people so that they can understand. You know, it's not like there's just one approach to this, that there's pluses and minuses to each of these approaches. And then making a business decision about, you know, what's the right approach to take? What can we deliver on time? What will our technology platform support? You know, all those things come into play, and all the team members contribute to that. The way we're organized at LinkedIn is we sit with the product team. So I don't sit with my fellow designers. I sit with the product area that I work with. And I'm right there with the engineers and the product managers and the front-end web developers. And so we're constantly collaborating all day. And then I go back to the design team and my fellow designers, and we talk about design patterns, we talk about synergies and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But it's very much bridging those disciplines and kind of pulling everything together.
When you mentioned design patterns, applying them, it occurs to me that we are talking about both your work at LinkedIn and also at Yahoo heavily involve elements of Web 2.0, both the rich internet application, Ajax kind of interface work that's sort of bringing elements of the desktop to the browser, also the whole notion of the read-write web and the contribution, the ratings and commenting that people do on both the, you know, the Buzz, Yahoo, as well as that kind of contribution and that kind of social contribution of discussions with regard to groups and all the rest of it at LinkedIn. I wonder if you could talk a little about your own sense of the transformation that's happened and the challenges perhaps and the opportunities in design that Web 2.0 has brought about, both in terms of the user interface design itself as well as the overall elements of building in some of these, you know, read-write components into the UI as well.
Sure. Well, the web, when it first started to become popular in the mid to late 90s, was kind of a step backwards in a lot of respects for the user interface. So those of us who are working on desktop applications and for years have been designing, you know, user interfaces for Macintosh and Windows, we looked at the web and said, boy, that's really limited. Basically, mm-hmm. You've got a form, you fill it out and you click submit and the screen blinks a few times. And yeah, it's got some pretty pictures, but from an interaction point of view, it's very limited. And it was stagnant for many years. And it was, frankly, it was kind of frustrating. There were a lot of jobs there and there's a lot of money to be made. So a lot of us worked in that space anyway. Mm-hmm. But thank goodness it's finally changed. And so now there's enough standardization across the browsers that we and bandwidth has improved to a point where we, you know, the last few years, it's been about four or five or more years, have started to see much more DHTML and then more recently AJAX in the UIs. And so, it's DHTML was very important because it allowed us to show and hide things, to pre-populate forms, to do interesting things. AJAX was very important because it allowed us to not have to download all the data from that up front. We could basically design UIs that did that on demand. So when the user needed that data, we could then go back up to the server and retrieve. We didn't have to do it all up front and suffer the page load penalty for it. So it's become a lot more interesting. The interesting thing was that the generation of web designers that had come out of the late 90s weren't really ready for that. So there was a period of kind of uncomfortable transition, which I think we're mostly over now, where a lot of the early web design was done in Photoshop, static JPEGs and PSDs of what the UI could be, and that didn't really work well for the interactive web. So now more and more important is rapid prototyping tools, which were important on the desktop for many, many years, and just the ability for designers, either through DHTML or through Flash or through some other mechanism to quickly dummy up and mock up their interactive designs.
Oh, and it sounds like it's also a change in the way in which you design for the for groups of people to contribute themselves as well to your UI, right? You used to be able to design UIs on the web in particular that people would only consume and would only read, and occasionally, as you say, you'd write a form and contribute something back, but really wasn't all that interactive. When you look at the elements of the UI that you've been building in at Yahoo and also some of this work at LinkedIn, of having people directly contribute, whether it's ratings and commenting and the like, I'm struck by one of the findings was that something like less than 1% of everybody out there that is on and deals with YouTubes and Dig and all these other sites actually contributes anything, whether it's ratings or comments or content or whatever, right? Now, you have been designing for, UIs and components that go out to, millions of people, and so that 1% doesn't affect you as much because you do have a large audience. But I wonder if you could tell us about any of the UI challenges or user experience and design challenges and more generally in dealing with designing for that level of interactivity or occasionally non-interactivity as well.
Well, you definitely do that analysis up front. So for Yahoo Buzz, for instance, we did personas, and we did the analysis of, you know, the contributors as opposed to the consumers and all of that, and the publishers as well. So those are all audiences that you need to take into account when you do the design and make sure that you're emphasizing the right things and that you're presenting the features to, you know, the appropriate audience at the right time. You know, you just have to have that up front. I mean, it's true. Wikipedia, for instance, is a classic example where, you know, I'm a Wikipedia user all the time. I love it. And, you know, I do most of, you know, just my straight, you know, non-people research on that. If I'm going to research a place or a topic or something, I go to Wikipedia. But it's true that, you know, a very small percentage of users actually create that. I've never created anything for Wikipedia, so I'm one of those people in that case that's a consumer and not a contributor.
Mm-hmm. Well, these changes in user interface and overall user experience, certainly through browsers, to some degree, as you said, Kevin, are really getting us on the web up to par, perhaps, with what was available on the desktop some years ago, and also starting to stretch, I would imagine, the UI in some unique ways. But where do you see all this going? Like, if you think of a few years, 5 years from now, you know, are we going to see, you know, 3D interfaces that we're already starting to see now on the web? Are we going to have influences of, you know, game design? I noticed the statistic the other day that there's now the amount of money brought in by games, by game software, is twice that of Hollywood, you know, in a year. So it's this huge influence of games. Just really appreciate your thoughts on where do you think, you know, all this is going? You've been around this for a while. What where do you think the trajectory is for what we might see in the future?
Boy. The limiting factor at some point becomes the human being. You know, what amount of information can we process? And, you know, we have two eyes, we have ears, you know, we have tactile, senses. But, you know, those, you know, unless we start, you know, evolving or genetically modifying ourselves, those aren't going to change. So at some point, you know, we're going to bump up in against that as a limiting factor. There have been lots of attempts to replicate real life out on the network, mm-hmm. with some success, but limited success. I mean, some of the more immersive environments. And then, you know, you have to ask yourself, you know, that's okay for fun. You know, it's okay for games and stuff like that, and which, as you pointed out, is a huge market. But, you know, there are limits to that as well. What about productivity? What about, business relationships? What about, managing my personal finances or my children's educations and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So I think there's always going to be kind of the enjoyment part of it, and then there's going to be kind of the more productivity part of it. And, you know, there's obviously some overlap between that. One of the trends that, you know, this isn't any huge insight, but I think it's pretty obvious, is that, you know, in portable devices, you know, a few years ago, you saw people that were carrying both a cell phone and a palm device. Mm-hmm. You know, it was pretty obvious that was a silly thing to have to carry both of those, or maybe two or three of them, right? And they had a GPS device in addition to that.
Right.
So, I mean, one of the trends, obvious, is all of that's going to be consolidated. I think that we're all, you know, and we're already very close to this, we're going to have devices that we carry with us that are going to have an awful lot of our personal information of interest with us that we can then plug in. So we can dock into our car, we can dock into, maybe a terminal at a Starbucks or an internet cafe or something, or that we can share certain, you know, we can beam certain information to other people. And they're going to become more and more efficient. And it's going to be how we connect and how we get information about things around us.
Mm-hmm. I think those are very insightful, actually, observations of where things are going. And I'm really excited, too, to hear your insights and your experience in particular that you could provide for the people in the audience here who really are at a stage where they're considering, you know, what kinds of things they should develop in terms of skills in order to be really good in user experience and design. You've been around both as a designer as well as you've been a manager of user experience design types of staff. I'd love to hear your thoughts on what kinds of skills do you think are most key to being successful in this set of disciplines.
Well, the kind of the classic breakdown of skills has traditionally been interaction design, visual design, and research. And they're periodically called different things: information architect, customer insights professional, various things like that. But it is basically those three things. And there's obviously people who just specialize in one of those areas, and then there's people who generalize and do more than one. What I've seen is, you know, people very often start in one of those specialties, but through, you know, osmosis or, you know, interest or you know, what have you, they tend to branch out. So I've seen a number of people who started off in visual design, maybe with a fine arts degree, who then have moved into more of an interaction design type role. I've seen a number of people who started off in research who branched out. I know a lot of folks who do both interaction and visual design. You know, they tend to, you know, have, you know, the strongest skills in one or those other areas. But particularly working for a startup, there's less, you know, there's less of a distinction, and, you know, basically you're asked to do a bunch of different things. You know, definitely a fine arts degree is probably where most of the visual designers come from. When I was in school, there was no HCI type degree, mm-hmm. So I actually have a master's in cognitive psychology, and moved into that from that into design, and have done, you know, visual interaction and research during my career. But it's definitely been an evolutionary sort of thing. You know, now there are degrees that are specialized to human computer interaction, and some very, very good, very good programs. One of the things that, you know, I always encourage students to do is to don't just go through school and get your degree, but do some internships along the way, you know, more than one. You know, it's time well spent, and even if it delays your degree by a few months or even a year, it's going to count so much more when you do eventually go look for a job. It's also going to give the student a lot more information about, you know, really what do they enjoy doing, and what they don't necessarily like to do.
You also were describing, I think, your own sort of evolution as you're describing it, in terms of from, you know, what you took at university and then what you evolved into over the years. It's sort of a continuous learning cycle. How do you go about doing that on a day-to-day or week-to-week basis, Kevin? You're obviously really keeping up with what all is happening in the industry and our discipline area, as well as, you know, just making sure that you are vital yourself in terms of your own skills. What kinds of things do you do that keep you up to date with future and current and future developments?
Well, you know, working with people from different specialties, and I've learned, you know, have learned and continue to learn a tremendous amount from the companies I work with and the people I work with. And then, you know, I have periodically gone back and taken classes, and I did that early in my career, and I tend to do less of it now. But obviously, you know, just reading books, a lot of the web stuff. I've always been very big into prototyping, and you know, when I started doing that on the web in the 90s, there really weren't any books on it or anything. It was just more a matter of, you know, going out on the web, seeing what other people had done, basically looking at their source code. One of the great things about the web, although it's a little more difficult now, it's still possible, but it used to be very easy, would be if you liked, you know, how somebody did something, you could take a look at their HTML, you could look at their CSS and their JavaScript and basically say, hey, that's pretty cool. And I know people have done it with the work I've done as well. So that's just, you know, that's part of the web. Definitely, you know, the technology is changing so quickly that that you have to keep yourself plugged in. I remember the first time I heard about Flash, and it was while I was working at WebMD. And, you know, streaming video had always been, it just had a terrible performance hit over, you know, any network, you know, let alone the web. And the first time I saw a demo of Flash, it was on an advertiser's website, KMGI, and I was just blown away that they were able to do that quality of streaming media over the web that quickly. Mm-hmm. And so it's like I just, you know, blasted out to my company, you know, we have to start doing at WebMD, we were very big on demos, you know, basically for consumers, you know, who are having healthcare problems, and then also physician demos and stuff like that. And we've been using some really archaic technologies, everybody was, to do that. And it's like, you know, here's the technology for it. And, you know, within a few months, we had converted everything over to Flash. And, you know, it just, it's a matter of kind of watching what's going on out there and looking for synergies and then, you know, promoting those synergies.
Yeah, I saw some of the work by reading your blog, kevinbury.com, wasn't that what you were saying?
Yeah.
The work that you did on Yahoo, I guess on the homepage, of some enhancements to the UI of actually his streaming video as well, which is something obviously very, very important in the kind of multimedia that we're actually putting on our UIs today. And I think you had some really nice and insightful, innovative work that you were doing, you know, there as well. So you're obviously keeping up with all of this stuff and applying your knowledge as well. And I think one of the first prototyping tools I ever used, and we won't actually say the year because it was a long time ago, it was actually written by you. I think we'll...
FSDPC.
There you go. Now, you've been more than generous with your time, Kevin. I've asked a lot of questions about a variety of topics here. I wanted to give you the opportunity before we finish up to maybe talk about anything else you think might be relevant that you have a soapbox about that you want to talk about, or anything else that we may not have covered yet.
Well, I think we've covered a lot of territory, and it's always really interesting to chat about stuff like this. So, you know, I've really enjoyed it, and like you say, I've got a blog. I'm also obviously I have a LinkedIn profile, you know, please feel free to point your listeners to those.
Sounds great. Well, thanks ever so much for this, Kevin. It was a delight to speak with you, and we'll also make the links available in the show notes that are available at a new URL. The old URL still works as well, which is karlvredenburg.podbean.com, but the new URL is uxdesigncast.com, which is much more intuitive and shorter, and you can get the links there. But Kevin, thanks so much for this, and thanks to everyone else who's been listening to this, and we'll talk to you all next time. Bye
Thank
for
you,
now.
Carl.